following podcast is part of the Underdog Sports Podcasting Network. For a full list of our shows, as well as breaking sports news and engaging feature stories, visit us at www.theunderdogsports.com.
Welcome to The Leftovers, brought to you by the Underdog Sports Network, with Josh Dunn, Anshu Khanna, and Dan Bauer. Welcome in to The Leftovers. This is episode 5. This one's going to be released on December 22nd, our last episode before the Christmas holiday. So I say to you guys, Dan Bauer and Anshu Khanna, a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, my friends. Welcome.
Thank you for the Happy Holidays specifically for me. I really appreciate that non-denominational greeting.
Like that? Politically correct. It is 2017 after all. Dan, how you doing this evening?
Doing great, Josh. Really excited to have the whole crew back for this last episode before Christmas and the holidays.
Likewise. This is going to be a fun one, too. We've got a lot of content to go through here today, so I want to get right to it. Don't want to waste a lot of time. We're going to talk a little baseball, and I know, Dan, Anshu, this is a topic that you guys love to discuss, starting with Manny Machado. We've actually talked about this within a couple of previous episodes. A lot of talk about where's Machado going to go. He's been on the block. He's one of the biggest names out there. So, Dan, bring us up to speed on the latest on the Machado news.
Yeah, a very long story short on Manny Machado is it looks like he's going to be staying in Baltimore. The O's are just not getting an offer that they really want. There's some tension with the front office and the owner of whether they want to move them. So all kinds of turmoil going on in Baltimore. But for what it's looking like now, Manny Machado will still be an Oriole come first pitch 2018. So, Anshu, I know we've talked a lot about this topic. Does it surprise you that he's staying?
Not in a vacuum, but like if you think of with the whole chain of events that's occurred over the last few days, I am shocked. First of all, we had the news mid last week during the winter meetings that Machado was being, you know, bandied about because he's going to be a free agent. And then now Zach Britton ruptures his Achilles, I believe was the injury, which means he'll be out from 4 to 6 months for an Orioles team that was already looking unlikely this year. If you think about the Yankees looking like a superpower in the AL, the Red Sox only going to get better and always a contender. And you would think that this Orioles team would potentially sell off some of its team for parts. And instead, they're turning around and they want to keep Machado, which makes little sense. Remember, once opening day hits, when they trade Machado, the team, assuming they lose him in free agency, loses their compensatory pick, right? So, like, the idea is, as long as you get traded before the season, that team will still have the ability to recoup like a second and a fifth rounder for him if they lose him in free agency, which they're likely to do, whoever it is. So it's just, it blows my mind because I think that, you know, this is really the last gasp that they have to sell him for the value that they probably think that he at least deserves. And I just, it's really surprising to me that they're just taking him off the table. It's bizarre.
Real quick to both of you, do you think it was a matter of they weren't seeing the value that they expected that they would out of Machado? I mean, that has to be the reason that they weren't giving him away, because with teams like, you know, both Chicago squads in the running and some other teams out there that were looking at Machado, obviously the packages that they were expecting to see weren't there, correct?
Yep, that's what I've seen. I mean, the fact is, Josh, that like they have a bunch of teams that were interested in him. I can't imagine that at least one of them didn't give him the offer that they wanted. But then the other part of me is like, if the White Sox are even considering being involved in this, they must not be getting good offers, because the White Sox just don't have any real good reason to trade for Machado right now. I don't know, Dan, if you agree with all that, but I feel like I think Josh is right. I think they must not be getting the offers they want.
Yeah, and I would agree, and I think it's because a lot of the teams that you mentioned, they didn't have a need for Manny Machado. I mean, obviously you want the bat, and maybe need's not the right word, but didn't have a spot for him. You know, if you're the White Sox, you have a young team, you want to get your guys up there. Somebody like the Indians is all set on the left side of the infield. I mean, there's a lot of the teams that are bandied about just didn't have a place to put him.
Yeah, I do think you brought up a good point, and we just kind of brushed past it early, which is the ownership is a factor. I mean, Peter Angelo straight up is a difficult guy to deal with. He's afraid, allegedly, reportedly, that whoever trades for him would then flip him to the Yankees, which is probably justified. And so I think that is ultimately the final hurdle. But it's still just, I just feel like you got to deal him now before the season starts, because even if it's just a pittance, you're going to get less as the season goes on, I think.
That makes sense. So a few other baseball moves happening here in the last couple days since the last time we released. Dan, do you want to walk us through some of the other things taking place as we move beyond Machado?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll do the kind of minor signings first, then we'll go to the bigger story. So today the Indians signed Yonder Alonso, find their replacement for Carlos Santana. I don't want to spend a ton of time on it. We'll briefly touch on it. I actually have an article coming out on The Underdog, so check it out on my thoughts overall. But long story short...
Shameless plug.
But long story short, Yonder's a guy who very similar and slightly better numbers than Carlos Santana last year. He's going to be getting $8 million for 2 years as compared to Carlos Santana getting $20 million per year for three in Philadelphia. So a very good replacement for that first base spot for the Indians, but a guy who hasn't really been consistent. Last year was by far his biggest year in terms of power, so we'll see if he can keep that up. Matt Adams goes to the Nats, so they get a first base bench player as well. So those are the two kind of quick ones. The big story, the Giants trade for Evan Longoria and get the Rays get Christian Arroyo in return. He's a top 100 prospect and seemingly going to be a guy who's fast-tracked to a very significant role with them. A couple other players involved in that. But they're kind of big ones. Going back to what we talked about earlier is, another team, the Rays, not going to contend in the East. So they're in this weird limbo point of, are they in a rebuild or are they simply getting rid of a big contract? So, Anshu, what are your thoughts? Is this the Rays' beginning of a teardown or just simply they don't want to pay Evan Longoria? I believe it's like $86 million he's still owed on that contract.
Ooh, I don't know if it's that much, but they're taking on Denard Span's money, so it's not just a straight money throwaway. That being said, Evan Longoria's star is much shinier than it actually is in terms of quality, if that makes sense. Like he's not the player he was. As we were talking about, a two-win player last year, which is pretty good. He's still a really good defensive player, but, this dude, Longoria is going to be, 32 and a half next year. I mean, you're trading for the post-prime version of Longoria. That being said, all they gave up was Christian Arroyo, who I know he's a top 100 prospect, but I'm not blown away by him. I definitely don't think this is like a sign of things to come or something for the Rays, although they lose Alex Cobb in free agency, it looks like, and now they're trading Longoria. But this is a team that constantly turns it out, and they have a lot of good upper minors talent that's going to be ready here soon. So I like the deal really for the Rays, honestly, even though I don't like Arroyo. I just think that they're clearing space to do something else. They still have Chris Archer. They still have Kevin Kiermaier, who's like the best outfielder in baseball defensively, and they're so well positioned to be good in the next couple of years.
Good stuff. So yeah, a lot happening in the baseball world right now. I appreciate you guys keeping us all in the loop as we move into the off season and further into the off season, I should say. So moving along, we wanted to talk a little bit about this. This is something that Anshu and I have talked about before. And Dan and I have talked about off the air before as well. But the Bulls are on a little bit of a tear right now. And I know that's your team, Anshu. But you've always had kind of a certain way about a team when they're in a rebuild mode. So for this team who's now on a 7-game win streak after losing, I think it was like 10 or 11 in a row.
Yeah, 10 in a row.
Give me your thoughts. Let's revisit this topic. So winning 7 in a row, they're now 10 and 20. They're not quite in position for the playoffs. But, do you still feel that this team should be in tank mode? Or do you think, you like seeing the fire out of these youngsters?
I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. But I would love to see them show the fire without winning, honestly. Like, I know, I'll be honest, I watched against the Sixers and I'll watch tonight at the Cavs. They just started, and I just, you know, I, It's tough to root against them. This particular Bulls team is a lot of fun, actually, to watch. David Nwaba is one of the most fun, random players in the league that you'll see. And just, like, seeing the guys compete is good. You know, you want to see that, especially if Fred Hoiberg is going to be their coach. And you see guys like your brother Chris Dunn and, you know, Lauri Markkanen. Those are the guys that are going to be important and be there when they're good. That all being said, you don't want to see guys like Nico Mirotic just suddenly star turn. I mean, it's good for trade value, but it's not good for wins and losses. I mean, they need to tank. They need to get a top pick so that they can be good, because otherwise you're just going to be in this mired in mediocrity NBA hell. And I just don't want to see that happen to this franchise. And I do think that the Mirotic stuff is good for now, assuming they trade him at the deadline, and Robin Lopez as well. But they're much closer. As you said, they're 10-20, even after they're the hottest team in the league and they're 10-20. So that tells you how far they are from even being mediocre. I mean, I just think that you're closer to the bottom than top. So just bottom out and then get to where you want to be down the line.
Dan, you've watched a lot of less than mediocre teams over the years. So, I mean, just kind of looking at this from a fan's perspective, or from an, you know, from a writer's perspective, I guess you could say, what are your thoughts on the tank? I mean, would you prefer your team be in the middle of the standings, or would you prefer to see them tank and just try to rebuild to next year or look to the future? Because I've always been of the mindset that I want to see my team win as many games as possible. If the Cavs go, you know, 41-41 and they steal the 8th seed and they play in a 7-game series, I'm happier with that than I am to get the fifth or sixth pick in the draft.
Oh, so Dan actually tweeted about this with respect to Jeff Fisher, so I'm interested to hear his response.
So I think there are two different scenarios where you have to look at the tank issue. And one is if you have a young team, and one is if you have a veteran team. So if you're a veteran team, you never want to be in that, like, 8-8, you know, if it's football, that 8-8 hell. If it's basketball, you know, winning 36, 37, you know, 40, 42 games, because you're never going to be able to compete with a top seed, and there's really just there's nowhere to go. I mean, you're stuck in purgatory. If you're a young team, I think you want to see them win as many games as you can. And, you know, obviously I get plenty of comments on my Browns fandom. There is something, I think, to be said for developing a losing culture. And I think on some level you have that with a team like the Browns. So you don't want to tank too bad to a point where that's just the mentality. Is you do need to learn how to win. So if you're a young team, I want to see you win as many as possible. If you got a veteran team and you're just in that mediocre spot, you have to go full tank.
That's a very interesting way of putting it. I kind of like that.
I like that too.
As a fan, it's tough to root for a team to lose, I guess. And I get where Anshu's coming from. I mean, he's got a GM mind. That's why he looks at it that way. But I just, you know, I always want to see my team on the top at the end of a game. I watch a game to see my team win. At the end of the season, however many of them they won, great. But I want to see them win as many as possible. I guess we all have a kind of a different perspective on it, but it's interesting to think about that concept.
It's very difficult to watch a young team, to Dan's point, and really any team, to both your points, and like actively root for them to lose when you're a fan of them. It's very, very difficult. We went to a White Sox game last year, Josh, and I, you know, fully was on board the tank, and it, you know, we're at that game, the White Sox walk it off, and it was like, you know, you're not actively rooting for them to lose at any point. It's very difficult to do, even though abstractly you want them to be as bad as possible to get as good as they can in terms of wins and losses, to get as good of a pick as they can. But it's very, very difficult to reconcile those two thoughts when you're at the game and you're watching the team, because you root for those colors. It's tough to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we have a very good understanding of each other on this front and slightly different views on it. But at the end of the day, we're all in the same boat as far as our competitive nature in rooting for our teams.
Right.
So with that, I wanted to move on to something else that's kind of been in question as far as competitiveness with college football. And this is something that we talked about on a previous podcast last season. And it's something that's been getting more and more media attention as the years go by, and also more and more players who are doing this. So What do you got? I guess we'll start with you, Anshu, on this one. With college football players that are, you know, looking at most likely being drafted and sitting out their bowl game, whether it be important or not important, has your stance on this changed at all? Do you still feel as though this should be, you know, up to that player, or should there be a rule in place on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we're talking about a sport where coaches leave whenever they want. You know, how many, like Scott Frost, is he coaching UCF? Probably not. I mean, I in terms of the bowl game after leaving the Nebraska, we were talking respect to Arden Key. He's of LSU, probable top 10 pick, probable top 5 pick, really, and he's not going to play. Ed Orgeron came out today and said he wasn't playing. This happened last year with Christian McCaffrey with Stanford. I mean, these guys aren't indebted to anybody but themselves. And we see it in the pros, too, which we'll talk about in a little bit, I think. But, like, you know, it's just, to me, I think you're not owed, you don't owe the school or anybody anything aside from yourself when it comes to your stock. But you don't necessarily agree with that, do you?
Well, I mean, again, this comes back to the same kind of, in line with the same thing as we were just talking about with tanking. It's, for me, it's, you know, as a fan, I want to see my favorite players on the field, but this one I kind of get a little bit more from the player's perspective, because with football, an injury can end your career so easily, and we've seen that happen in the past. What was the running back's name for South Carolina that's name is
Lattimore?
Yeah, Marshawn Lattimore. That happened. I don't think it was a bowl game, but it was a late season game. Or
happened to Jalen Smith too of Notre Dame. He was going to be a top 3 to 5 pick. Ends up, like, he's still not the same, and this was 2 years ago. He's a Cowboys linebacker now.
Yeah, so I guess in that regard, and Dan, maybe, you know, you can chime in on this as well. I guess in that regard, to me, it should really be up to the player, and they should be able to make that decision based on whatever they think is best for their future in the NFL. Because the NFL careers, I mean, in a lot of those skill positions, they're getting shorter and shorter. Especially you look at the running back position. And that's why, you know, Christian McCaffrey didn't surprise me last year that he wanted to sit out his bowl game. That was really, you know, to me, it was kind of an irrelevant game anyway. So for somebody like that, all it takes is one little, you know, shift of the knee or an ankle, and you could potentially drop to another round or potentially end your career in one play. So, Dan, what are your thoughts?
So, yeah, I'll just go real quick. I know we have another topic in our new segment we want to hit, so stay tuned for that, listeners. But I think it's one of those things that if you're playing in the Capital One, whatever bowl, sit it out. I mean, if you're going to be a top 5 pick, a first-round pick, I completely get it. That being said, if you're one of the teams, if you're competing for a national championship, I have a big problem with people sitting out. I mean, those matter. Trying to win a national championship matters not only to you, but to everybody on your team. You know, for a lot of those guys, those are going to be the last football games that any of those people ever play. And as kind of cliche as it is, those are very important to people and the chance to play in a national championship game. So yeah, if you're going to just a bottom of the barrel bowl, sure, go ahead, sit it out. If you're competing for a national championship, I think you have to play. And I know,
I think the players get that too, right? I mean, if you're playing in a Final Four,
for sure,
you're going to play in that game. But if it's an irrelevant game, I think they should have the decision. So you mentioned a new segment. Anshu's going to kick this one off, but this segment's called the microwave segment, where we essentially look at something that either has come out in the media or a certain take that somebody has. Anshu, you happen to hear something over the last day or two that you wanted to put in the microwave. So, Dan, start the timer. Give you a minute before the food's ready. So let's throw the leftovers in there.
Okay, so normally I think the segment's going to be like to make fun of someone for some insanely hot take. But for me, I applaud Dan Le Batard. He had Rob Manfred on his show yesterday, his radio show, and he absolutely lit him on fire to continue the theme, I guess. He just destroyed Manfred. He basically attacked him about why the MLB approved of the Miami Marlins sale to a group that required massive loans. Basically, they didn't have the money to buy the Marlins. They buy the Marlins, and then they immediately turn around and sell off two of their best assets, who were also, you know, some of their most expensive assets in Giancarlo Stanton and Marcell Ozuna. And, you know, it just looks really bad, and it's bad for the competitive balance. And Levitard basically just lit him up, and Manfred had very little response, certainly very little, you know, actually professionally impressive response. So I just thought it was really great. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this Marlins thing. We talked about the Stanton stuff ad nauseum, but, you know, it's just, I think it was a good
ding
comeback. Damn.
Nice. There you go. I think our friend Corey will like to hear that. I don't know if he saw that segment, but
not a Jeter fan.
Not a fan. I don't know, Dan. Do you have any thoughts on it?
I mean, I, to be fair, didn't actually watch it. I saw the headline of it, so I cannot comment too much. But I mean, I think that the whole just Jeter selling it off, it does seem like there was some shadiness going on. I know the reports were that. There's conflicting reports of whether he told the other MLB owners that they were going to start selling off or what their payroll was going to be. Was it going to be 85 or 90, or, you know, how drastically the cut was. So, I mean, it does seem like there was some shadiness going on. You know, how much Rob Manfred knew, you know, I don't know if we'll ever know.
Fair enough. Yep. Last but not least, we always end the show with our Oh, By the Way segment. And Dan, you've got your eye on a story that was breaking today by your best buddy, Darren Rovell. sounds like Vince McMahon could be making some moves here. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so as of about an hour ago, Darren Rovell had tweeted that Vince McMahon had sold $100 million worth of shares in the WWE for his transferred that money, over to his new company that has all the trademarks for the XFL, and they filed 5 different trademarks related to the XFL. So it looks like we may actually have the XFL coming back, which I would love. Get He Hate Me, Tommy Max, get the whole crew back together. Maybe they can coach. But I personally, you know, kind of love the move. I was a big XFL fan. Probably helped that I was 12 years old and everything when that was going on. But I don't know. How about you guys? What do you guys think? If you were running the XFL, what's one rule you want to put in there? You know, something like the chasing down a football instead of a coin toss. What's he put in?
Well, you stole mine. I mean, that was obviously the most electric way to start a game ever. You know, watching two players, and usually two players that no one's ever heard of, because nobody, you're not going to throw your best player out there. Not that the XFL had a lot of significant talent. I think I remember Tommy Maddox the year after he drug the Steelers into the playoffs being one of the better players in the league. But the XFL was entertaining, and obviously that's the WWE's forte. So I did read that they were trying to trademark URFL, so that obviously alludes to the fact that there may have been a league. But I don't know, Anshu, what do you think? Was there anything else about the XFL? I think Jim Ross was one of the announcers. That was also kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the XFL birthed like some of the really interesting camera stuff that we see now, where the cameras like the players out onto the field, they're walking out. That's all XFL based, if I'm not mistaken. So their access was really cool, and I think that added to some of the stuff that the NFL was allowed to do. I think the celebrations are just going to be absolutely absurd, assuming the XFL comes back, which obviously the NFL's had some of that, but I could see the XFL just getting on another level. I'm interested to see if, again, this all happens, the social media impact, because I think that they'll be allowed to do a lot of stuff, like tweet from the bench and all that. So I could see there being a lot involved with the XFL and social media. But overall, you know, I mean, the coin flip is just so memorable, so, or the lack thereof.
Let me ask one more question. I know we have to wrap up, but I just want to ask one more question kind of with respect to that. So with these other leagues that have tried to form in football, especially because the NFL's become so big and has so much money, is it even possible to entice players to play a sport that's so violent when you can only pay them so little because the league just doesn't have enough money to pay them anywhere close to what they can make, even in, you know, Canada, for example?
Well, I to that, but just saying, I think that this sort of goes hand in hand with what we were talking about, the bowl games. I mean, you could see college players potentially go to this, you know? And I mean, I could also see like the advent of spread offenses, and the fact that everyone runs the spread and wants to see it. You know, I think that it's a very interesting middle ground and an interesting investment on Vince McMahon's part. Say whatever you want about him, but I could see this being a real opportunity to be like the Euro leagues in basketball, where we've seen a couple players every year go and play there instead of go to the college, you know, college football game. I think it could happen.
Fair enough. Dan, any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say on that note, I think Anchi makes a really good point about it being an interesting transitional league. I mean, if you look at LeVar Ball trying to do the same thing
yep.
in basketball. So obviously Vince McMahon has a little bit more success running a major enterprise than LeVar Ball does. But, you know, you may start seeing more of this kind of stuff. So
can you imagine? Can you imagine the next two minor league sports teams or sports leagues being led by LeVar Ball and Vince McMahon? Yikes, that's an interesting thought to end with.
Yeah.
All right. All right, boys, that's it. The December 22nd episode is in the books. Thank you again for joining us on The Leftovers. I don't think we'll be recording one on Christmas morning, but we'll definitely get you two episodes at least next week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.